Morning. Welcome to our meeting. It's 9 a.m. on March 18, 2025, and time to convene the regular meeting of the Snohomish County PUD Board of Commissioners. I'm Sid Logan, President of the Commission. Joining me today are Commissioner Tony Olson, our Vice President, Commissioner Julieta Alvarado Crosby, our Secretary, John Harlow, our CEO, Colin Willenbrock, our Chief Legal Officer, Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board, and Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or other electronic devices at this time. If you'd like to join me in the flag salute,
welcome to the flag of the United States of America.
To the Republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Copies of the agenda are located on the deputy clerk's table near the entrance. Commissioners, are there any items to be added or changes to be made to the public agenda?
I have none.
Okay. Comments from the public is item one on the agenda, and that's when the board will hear comments for items that are not listed on today's agenda. Comments will be limited to 5 minutes, and person shall be recognized to speak from the stand-up cards located on the deputy clerk's table near the entrance. Joining by Zoom, click raise hand or dial *9 if by phone. We'll call on you to speak at the appropriate time. When you are called upon and on a phone, dial *6 to unmute. This meeting is being recorded. When addressing the board during the meeting, please step up to the podium, use the microphone, state and spell your name, and indicate where you are from. Please remain at the podium while you speak and address the commissioner and not the audience. If you have documents or other materials to enter into the record, hand them to the deputy clerk, please. We will distribute them to the board. We appreciate your cooperation with our procedures. Please note that all motions receive an automatic silent second from the board. This ensures that all issues can be brought to the floor for discussion. So our first item is comments from the public. Are there any comments from the public on items that were not listed on today's agenda? Please raise your hand. Any hands up in the room? I'm not seeing any hands up online. Do we have any cards filled out? We'll move on to item two, our consent agenda. 2A, approval of the minutes for the regular meeting of March 25, 2025. 2B, bid awards for professional service contracts and amendments. And 2C, consideration of certification slash ratification and approval of district checks and vouchers. I'll call for a motion.
I move.
Any comments from the public regarding the consent agenda? So please raise your hand. Seen any? Okay. Commissioners, do you have any questions about the consent agenda?
I have no questions.
I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Motion carries unanimously. Next, item three, our CEO General Manager briefing and study session. This item is for the board and the CEO General Manager to discuss issues among ourselves and the PUD staff. Carl, our CEO, will facilitate any of this stuff. Good morning, John.
Good morning, commissioners. We have lots of good stuff on the agenda today to go through. First up was the legislative report in your packet, and we have our phenomenal GR team here to answer any questions.
Questions, commissioners? This is the informational one.
We have none.
Yeah, this is our update one.
Yeah.
Okay, we don't get into too much. Yes. No, I don't have any questions.
I don't have either. Thank you.
Okay, excellent. Then I'd like to call Jenna Peth up, our new government relations. Actually, I think she's going to be virtual, to talk a little bit about BPA and all the things that are going on with BPA workforce and other issues. So, Jenna, are you there?
Good morning, commissioners. I'm Jenna Peth, the Federal Affairs Specialist for the district. And today I wanted to provide a couple updates on federal policy issues that are of impact to the district. Starting off with workforce issues, BPA has faced significant challenges over the past few weeks. And while the situation is becoming more stable, thanks in part to recent court rulings, the effects of past workforce reductions as well as early retirements are still being felt at BPA. Several executive positions still remain vacant, and the departure of key subject matter experts has created some gaps in expertise. One major unknown is whether BPA will be subject to future federal workforce reductions, especially as broader efforts to reshape the federal government continue. Recent court rulings mandated the reinstatement of thousands of probationary federal employees who were terminated as part of the past workforce reduction efforts, including probationary BPA employees. At this time, it's a bit unclear whether the administration will fully comply with these court orders or how the reinstatements will impact future workforce reduction plans, which have been designed with more legally durable frameworks. And regardless, workforce concerns will remain a major point of discussion throughout the fiscal year 2026 appropriations process, which is the upcoming federal budget cycle, particularly as the administration continues its efforts to reshape federal agencies. And beyond BPA, we're tracking workforce reductions across other federal agencies, including the Bureau of Reclamation, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and the Army Corps of Engineers, as well as those at the Department of Energy and the Environmental Protection Agency, which could have significant ripple effects across the sector. To address these challenges, we're actively engaging with Congress and the administration to ensure that BPA and other critical infrastructure functions at the federal level are protected in these workforce reviews. And our goal is to reinforce the critical role of power marketing administrations like BPA and provide certainty for BPA's workforce moving forward. Shifting over to trade, the discussions have largely returned to the status quo, which is the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement, under which approximately 70% of trade is still covered under existing agreements. But we did want to note that some new tariffs have been introduced, and those are already having an impact on supply chains and trade flows. BPA has indicated that they are not currently impacted by potential hydropower tariffs included in the original tariff guidance from the administration, but it is an area of uncertainty in other regions that could have ripple effects. And more broadly, the latest round of tariffs has disrupted supply chains, which has prompted certain suppliers to assess risk mitigation strategies in anticipation of additional trade actions and uncertainty. And looking ahead, we do expect that additional retaliatory tariffs are going to be announced in early April. And we do anticipate that these will have more long-term durable consequences given the in-depth policy work that's going in to support those tariffs. And we're going to continue to track the tariff discussions closely and assess any potential impacts on our operations or project costs. And finally, I'd like to note that the House and Senate Republicans are currently engaging in a legislative process called budget reconciliation. Legislation drafted under reconciliation rules is largely tax focused, so we're monitoring any changes to clean energy tax credits or tax exempt bonding, both of which have major impacts to the district. And we're happy to provide updates as that process moves forward in Congress. Thank you, and happy to answer any questions.
Questions, commissioners?
I just need a point of clarification. When you talk about the impact of tariffs on power out of hydropower, is that the delivery of energy?
It's the delivery of energy. And just to be clear, that doesn't currently impact our region, but it is impacting the Midwest and Northeast.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
And just a point of clarification, another one, with regard to impact on Snohomish County, isn't a very high percentage of our economy based on imports? It come through our, I thought it was like 60% or something like that was linked to trade.
I know Boeing's, operation has a significant impact.
Which would in terms of the economy. Oh,
yeah.
That's probably what it's driven by. Good.
I have one. Oh, go ahead.
It's no question, it's a comment. Can we have this update in writing? I would like to see if it's possible that Jana can send an email and then this update. I mean, I would like to have that.
Yeah, I
we're happy to.
It is possible. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
We can make that happen.
Can you put update on the economy?
The update that she just mentioned and give to us, I would like to see if we can have it writing. Thank you.
I have one quick question for you. So the president has recently been discussing Canada's water. And I'm wondering water supply. And I'm wondering if we anticipate that's going to have any impact on the Columbia River, on getting the Columbia River treaty signed.
Yeah, I will. Jenny, you have any comments or response to Commissioner Logan's question on water in Canada?
Thank you, Commissioner Logan. Happy to dive into that a little bit. There has been some recent press on both water issues between the U.S. and Canada, and there has also been some press on the Columbia River Treaty itself. It does seem like the treaty is being caught up in some of these tariff discussions, so that's something we're monitoring at the federal level. Negotiations on the treaty are currently on pause, so we don't have to worry about necessarily any immediate impacts, but it's something we're tracking in terms of the shifting political narrative around the treaty.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Jenna. All right. Next up, I want to have Jeff Kallstrom come up. Yesterday, we were notified by the city of Everett that they had a water leak on one of their water transmission lines. Jeff and I had communicated back and forth yesterday as we managed their originally city of Everett had anticipated having that repair made yesterday evening. I think that's been extended, and Jeff can give us an update on all the things happening.
Yeah, so as John said, there was Jeff Kallstrom, Chief Water Operations Officer. As John said, the city of Everett had experienced a break on one of their mains. They have four mains that they operate, primary mains that they operate. One of them had the break. It occurred late Saturday night. They got crews on site Sunday, determined Monday morning that they could not conduct the repair with internal staff. So they had to bring in contracting staff, and that's what extended the timeline. We were informed at 7:30 this morning that the repair is complete, but the process of filling the pipeline and restoring service takes time. You can't just open up the gates full and completely fill it. We've been given permission to slowly fill our reservoirs. They give us certain draws that we can take off of them, allowing us to get our system back is their number one priority. So they're allowing us to fill first. So we're currently doing that now and directing water to our most impacted areas. We have several water reservoirs that we use to fill gaps like this. And then we have our own internal production at the Lake Stevens well. We ramped up that production. This time of year, the aquifer is very resilient, so we were able to pull quite a bit of water out of that and bring it as close to maximum as we could. But still, we were in a water loss situation. We could not make up the loss of supply from the city of Everett. We did get to a point. This happens on occasion. City of Everett has planned maintenance to their filtration plant, things like that. So we are set up to go up to 24 hours without supply from Everett again with our reservoirs and other means. The concern here, as John noted, is when the timeline got extended, we were thinking that we were looking at the end of the day today or late tonight before we'd be restored to service. So one of the actions, we took a few different actions, one of which is we issued a mandatory curtailment yesterday afternoon, asking residents or directing residents within the system to curtail their water usage through a variety of means. And then we also did shut off water, cease service to one commercial customer, a recreational park just outside of Lake Stevens. The shut off there was primarily due to loss of water. They're experiencing water loss on their system leakage. And in context, by disconnecting that customer overnight, we were able to save approximately 50,000 gallons of water. And in context, an average home the duration of an entire day utilizes 50 to 70 gallons of water. So we were able to, preserve about 900 homes worth of water by disconnecting that customer. It's a very difficult decision. We don't like to do that, but we did work with that customer, give them some notice, allow the recreational users to fill their tanks and try to make it through. And we will be returning them as soon as we are able. As of this moment, I think we're in good shape. We had no other disruptions. We were able to maintain water quality. None of that monitoring and activity was disrupted in any way. So those activities were able to constant and status quo and as we normally would. The main work was really monitoring the levels of the system and protecting pumps and protecting reservoir levels to make sure that we didn't end up in a situation where you're introducing air into the system or creating potential for backflow, which then would have water quality implications. With that,
Any questions for Jeff? Questions for Jeff?
So none of our, only one customer was without water completely, which was yes. That park.
Yes.
Everyone else was asked to curtail.
Yes, everyone else was asked to curtail. We did work, we have two wholesale customers, Arlington and Granite Falls. We worked with both of them. They also issued curtailments. We worked with fire departments, asking them to halt all truck washing, exercises, training that would utilize water. We asked them to notify us if they had a fire event or something where they were going to need to tap into a utilize fire flows. So that way we could modify the system and make sure they had sufficient water in that particular area. But those events fortunately did not occur. Brenda White was a tremendous help in working with me to make sure we kept the city of Lake Stevens alerted in case they received questions. So we had some communications with the city of Lake Stevens. So again, Brenda's help was very valuable with that. And then beyond that, it was just very close monitoring of the system and kind of making sure that we didn't start to approach a dangerous or otherwise unhealthy situation.
Do we have a feeling for what percentage the curtailment, how much reduction we achieve by asking people to?
So on that, I don't know that yet. Okay. We'll go back and look, and we'll try to do some rough numbers and compare usage. The Lake Connor Park, Recreation Park, that one is fairly easy because we compare usage and they went to zero. But system-wide, we'll take a look and see what effect it had. We are in the process of revising response plans, emergency response plans, things like that. And so this was a great opportunity to test our current drought response plan. And we've already found some areas for improvement. And the information that you're talking about will be another one is, the methods that we utilize to communicate the curtailment. Maybe we might be able to improve upon those as well.
Any follow-up questions for Jeff?
I have a follow-up question. Define customer, is that just one individual customer or service?
So it's usually typically a single meter. So like Lake Connor Park is a recreational park. So it's for us, it's a single customer, it's a single meter, but they have about 200 slips. They have 10 permanent residents, and this is their off season. So that also played into kind of the discussion of the amount of water we can save. And then we are working with them on resolving their leakage scenario.
Thank you.
Excellent, thank you, Jeff. And one failure on my part, I should have given you all a heads up yesterday when this was going on, and especially when we were putting together our communication plan to our customers. So lesson learned from my part to make sure you are all aware of what's going on. And to Jeff and the water team, they did a phenomenal job managing through all the entire situation. But lesson learned for me to make sure you're all aware of what's going on. All right, next up is a Snow Smart update and Kevin Labering and team. Morning, Kevin.
Morning, John.
Morning, commissioners.
Morning.
All right, so we're excited. I'm here with John Heap, who's a principal engineer and project manager in the Snow Smart program. And as we mentioned last time, we'll bring in project managers to help out with these quarterly presentations that we'll be providing to the commission. Our last time we were here was, last update was in December of 2024. There we go. All right. So the purpose of today's presentation is to provide a quarterly program update to the commission and just to help you remain informed of the progress of the program and our next steps. So our agenda, we'll do a quick review of the scope of the overall program, provide some updates at the program level. We'll also give an update on the budget and schedule for the program. And then we'll dive into the individual projects that comprise the overall program and how each of those are progressing. So program scope, just a reminder on this one. So this program will be installing hundreds of wireless connected smart grid devices into our distribution grid. Also deploying a new SCADA system that will control those devices. And so great benefits, really love this program of the positive things that it's providing to our customers. One is around the FLISR or the fault location isolation and service restoration. And so this is this will this ability will help us to be able to locate faults out in our system more quickly, make them have fewer customers impacted by them as we're able to isolate them. And then thus the overall average outage will be shorter for our customers because of that. We also have, this will also enable us to be able to have VoltVar or VVO. And so this is our ability to adjust voltage levels during times of peak demand. For example, if we have a deep freeze, deep cold situation, that we'll be able to adjust voltage levels delivered to our customers to be able to save money. However, we'll be using AMI meters to be able to confirm that we're delivering the adequate amount of power to our customers during those times. And then wildfire and extreme weather mitigations, we will have reclosers or these smart grid devices that will be installed in certain areas of our district to help out during times of high risk fire situations. And so we'll be able to have these reclosers, they will be able to eventually automatically open up and stay open, not close again if there's a fault condition that is sensed. And a great benefit of this program is it's helping to accelerate a lot of work that we're planning on over the next 20 years into a 5-year time frame. So at the program level, some updates. The program is on schedule, and we've received our first cost share reimbursement from the Department of Energy, and we're preparing our second reimbursement request coming up. We also submitted, we have a number of reports to help report to the Department of Energy how the program is progressing cost-wise, schedule-wise, scope-wise, and so we were able to submit that batch of reports in January, and we'll do those on a quarterly basis to them.
Okay.
We've also, at a program level, just internally doing some normal program steps. We've done a quarterly or an assessment of our stakeholders, and so we've identified a number of managers, the experts within the district that we want to keep updated of the progress of the program. And so we just had our first meeting a couple weeks ago, and we'll be holding those on a quarterly basis. Also, as part of a normal program approach, we've done an assessment of our dependencies and have looked at the projects that SnowSmart is dependent upon. And then on a quarterly basis, we're monitoring those and we'll report back at a program level just to ensure that those dependencies are also on schedule. And then we've started, we want our employees to be part of this journey also. And so CorpCom is helping us out greatly with this, with internal communications. We're seeing highlights article. There was a Snow Smarty article that came out. We love that name. Just last month. And then we were part of the Between Two Squirrels, initial Between Two Squirrels presentation that took place last month also. We had fun with that. As far as our budget, we have a $74.2 million budget, and we're currently on track with that. Currently, we've spent a little over $500,000. With those reimbursements, we received a $91,000 reimbursement from DOE a few months ago, and then we're in the works of putting together a second reimbursement for $160,000. That's through the end of January. And then this current spend is through the end of February, so we'll be asking for more reimbursement on top of that. So it's about half of what our costs are.
Remind me, what's the percent?
So
that's coming from federal money.
They are matching the first $30 million. So we overall $74 million, first $30 million they're matching.
I have a question. With all these collaboration with the Department of Energy, and all these changes that happens in the federal level, they're going to be impact and some level they, I don't know if they're going to impact this program of collaboration that we have with.
Yes, as far as our collaboration, what's kind of the current sense, things are going really well for our program. With your other utilities, they're having not as much success, I guess, or much of a green light to move forward. Our program is, we've had the green light to move forward continually. We just met with the Department of Energy last week, and we're happy that our contacts that we're working with, which we have a great relationship with, are still there. And so we're still working with them and have that continuity going forward.
And what about the funds?
Yes, so the funds there, so of the $30 million, about 0.25% of those funds are the only ones that are in question right now. So it's a very, very small amount. And that's just around some of the priorities that the prior administration have are different than the current administration around the DEI area, for example. So we had a very small portion focused on that. And that's the part that's in question right now.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Other questions?
One follow-up. This is primarily system enhancement improvement. So I would think that would be one area that might overall be impacted, because it has really to do, right, with environmental green energy, or it really is system improvement.
It is system improvement and wildfire mitigation, and some aspects of the wildfire mitigation, especially related to the Justice 40, that was part of the overall application and process.
Yeah, right.
That's the piece that Kevin is referring to.
Yeah.
It's a very heavy system improvements, infrastructure type project. So really supported by the current and past administration.
Well said. Thank you.
Welcome. Okay, this is our schedule for the overall program. We have the DAI project, which is distribution automation, that John Heap will be talking about all these projects in just a minute. And this project will be installing those smart grid devices out in our distribution grid. And this will take place all the way through 2029. And then we'll still have areas of the district as we choose whatever pace we choose to that will continue that work. And then the lower two swim lanes, as we call them, are our ADMS system. And so that's around our SCADA and ADMS project. Two phases for that. First phase is setting up the platform for it. And then our second phase, which will go from 2027 through 2029, will be our advanced applications.
Where on here will we start receiving benefits? I mean, obviously we're receiving at the end. But we'll be receiving benefits any place else before then?
Yes, great question. Yeah, so yeah, like you mentioned, once the advanced applications are installed, that's when we'll be able to start seeing our full benefits. However, in 2027, once our first our reclosers are being installed and we have our new ADMS system up, we'll be able to still see benefits from wildfire mitigation. We'll still have those devices will be installed, and we'll be able to control those at that time. So we'll see some benefit from that. Thank you. You're welcome. And our external relations plan. So this is work outside of the grant, work that we would normally do. We want the public to be a part of this journey also. And so we have a number of great events that are coming up. We have our monthly city managers, administrators meeting today at noon. So we're excited. So we're happy we were able to present early today, so we can get to that later. So that's just reaching out to some government officials to help them understand the benefits of this program, to have them be part of the team, really. And then we have a number of other events, PUD Coffee Chat, North County Ribbon Cutting, Tulalip Community Energy Event, and then the Block Party coming up in April. So this is just over the next month and a half, events that we'll be able to share with the public, the benefits that are coming their way.
Is the monthly manager, you said that there were elected officials at the First Public
Yes, these are our city administrators. I don't know if they're elected or that's a paid, normally paid position. Yeah, yes. And then this shows a map of areas that we're focusing on. So you have the shaded area there. If you look outside of that shaded area, those bigger dots are substation locations, areas that are reliability numbers we'd like to improve. And so those will be the areas that we'll be focusing this program on. Regarding wildfire mitigation, some of those bigger dots that you see there, so Sultan Gold Bar area on the lower right corner, upper right corner, Darrington, upper left corner, Camino Island, and then Granite Falls right in the middle there. Those are areas that we have heavily forested locations, and they'll be receiving a focus of our wildfire equipment.
Did the grant not cover the shaded area?
No. It did. There will, well, let me say something. So the equipment will be installed outside of the shaded area, and the grant inside the shaded area will be work that we'll do after the program. However, all the whole entire district will benefit from our new SCADA and ADMS system. All right. Any other questions up to this point? Okay. All right. Hand it over to John Hebel. Give us updates on some of our projects.
Morning, Commission. John Hebel, Principal Engineer and Distribution Automation Infrastructure Project Manager. I need a shorter title.
Bigger business card.
So I'm here to talk about some of the finer details of some of the projects we're working on. Starting with the object of my heart here, the Distribution Automation Infrastructure, DAI. Focus of this slide is really all about scope. We're going to be deploying hundreds and hundreds of pieces of equipment on the distribution grid. It's a massive investment in our system. And what we're showing in the picture on the top right is that was our first test recloser install in Arlington. So we're going to be deploying about 400 of those, and then, you know, several hundred of other types of devices.
You don't have the ADMS system in yet. Can our existing SCADA work with these devices now?
Yeah, and I wanted to touch on that. So okay. One of the benefits is as we're deploying this, we're adding it to our SCADA system. So we'll be able to get all the information, notified when there's faults, and get greater visibility for our system operators. But the end of the project is when we start doing that, the software is really starting to do some of the heavy lifting, but our operators will be able to open and close these devices and, you know, add flexibility to our grid in the short term. So updates on this project, as of about a month ago, we signed a contract with our vendor for the largest piece of equipment, those three-phase reclosers. That was about $10.5 million worth of equipment. And we will be charged for that upon delivery. So we've got a 4.5-year delivery schedule associated with that contract. We're working on some engineering design services contract with a consultant. Some of the work groups in engineering have been impacted by the latest budget, a lot of BO polls are in there. So we're looking for outside help. Expect to get that contract nailed down and come back to the commission in about a month with that, look for approval of that contract.
BO polls for the commissioner, BO.
Bad order, yeah.
Who is our vendor?
That will be David Evans Associates Engineering Firm. We're still working through the scope of work, so it's not finalized, but that was the selection. As far as design workshops, this is something that I'm really excited about, where we're partnering with our field personnel, energy control center, and engineering, and really looking at where we want to put all this equipment in the field. And so it provides the best benefits for reliability, but also for access for our field personnel. So We've done seven, actually that's eight now, and we're kind of on the prob about 1 to 2 a month. So we should finish that design sometime around next year. So we'll know where everything's going to go. And then the most exciting bullet for me in the whole presentation is get distribution automation in ECC's hands. We've been going through training and updating our processes and procedures and making sure everyone knows that this is coming. And as of last week, sent out a memo to the different work groups, you know, asking for approval to make this switch. And that switch is all the equipment that we have in the field. And we've got about 15 to 20 of these DA devices already installed and tested, basically transferring the control from the local field personnel to our control center. So now our operators can operate those devices remotely. So that's a gigantic deal, and it should be coming in the next coming weeks.
Leadership and the team should be commended for that, because that's a
This was a big deal. Yeah. So excited about that. And then just real quick touch, we're working with other work groups to try and optimize, you know, when our crews are out doing work in the field, can we also, while they're there, add a DA recloser switch? So we got that communication across engineering field. And then finally, we have work orders and projects that are in process. We've got testing going on, and this is, we're in the active deployment phase now. So exciting. That was a lot. Any questions on that?
No, I haven't.
All right, so then the update on the ADMS system, and I can speak relatively intelligent on this. The if you're a fan of acronyms, this is the slide for you. I see that we missed one for the fault location analysis. That's actually FLA. But this is...
We first might want to explain for our new commissioner what this system does briefly.
Sure, absolutely.
Sorry about that.
So this is the SCADA and ADMS platform system, where SCADA is all about bringing information from our substations and from our field equipment into the control center and handling all the communications. And then what the ADMS system is basically using that information, coupling it with our grid analysis tools, and providing recommendations to our system operators on how to operate the grid more efficiently, or alert them when there are things like low voltages or high currents that they need to be aware of. So that's at the very highest level what the system is. The system touches so many different work groups. You know, everyone in engineering operations knows about these systems, but also integrates with our SAP system, with customer phone calls, with AMI meters. It really is a enterprise level system.
Thank you. It's fascinating.
Thank you. Yeah.
Good explanation.
All right, good. So the first set of bullets, the SCADA, the OMS, the DMS, the EMS, and mobility, those are the largest applications. And then the second set of bullets, where we're talking about fault location analysis, FLISR and VBO, that's all the phase two stuff. That's the smart grid stuff that we're going to tie to our DDA system that will really be doing those great benefits for our customers at the end of the project. That's a little bit about what the ADMS system is. Update about where we are in that project right now, and this is being led by Sheila Crawford and a few others. Finished the design system or the system design, which is basically how many servers do we need, how many workstations, how do we connect all the stuff together so that it works properly. And then the activities that are going on right now, in fact, there's a meeting I should be in right now. it's all about how do we design for this new system that we're changing from a thing that we were used to for years to a new system. How do we want it to look? How do we want it to function? And so that's what's going on today. And then, you know, kind of coming up in April is some of the new stuff that we're going to be deploying. So a field mobility solution so that our field personnel can see how the grid looks right now as opposed to the static version that they have today. And so really cool stuff coming up.
So these are running dual for a while, right? As you implement each section. I mean, you're not cutting over from old to new, aren't they running? You are cutting over.
Good question. So this project is split into two phases. The first phase is all about the core base function of the SCADA, bringing information in so our operators can see it. And I think that also includes the OMS, the outage map, the software that drives the outage map. And then phase two is the advanced applications that I'm excited about.
Thank you.
Yeah. So that's a big switchover. So essentially the SCADA system will be replaced.
That's right.
And like going from Windows to iOS. That'll be fascinating.
It is. That is an exciting time.
You're Y2K.
Long needed.
Yeah.
Lots of verification going on throughout this project. All right. And then the third project that I'm going to talk about here is our corporate historian. And at the highest level, this is all about providing access to, you know, everyone at the company that needs access to our system information, our currents and voltages and amps. So engineers use this all the time, data and analytics, providing all that information outside of that secure SCADA environment. Yeah. So what this project is all about is taking all that information, storing it in a good, in a secure place, but also providing tools for end users to access and visualize all that information that we're collecting. So,
have access,
no.
Or is it selected?
Yeah,
those that are linked to
that would need the information to do
okay.
To perform
thank
their,
you.
Their job.
So these are things like voltages, frequency, those kind of things. At all the different points in the system we're measuring and then keeping historically, is that what?
That's right.
Okay.
So the update on this project, we have an existing product that's called eDNA, and we're replacing that historian product with this new Aviva Pi. And the next slide, yes, talks about the progress of this project. I have done the kind of a similar project with the ADMS. We've done the high level design. This project's a little bit behind in that they're going through contract negotiations today, finishing up the scope of work. The intent is to finalize the contract this month and hopefully come to the commission with for approval of that contract in April. This is a shorter project. I'm not going to quote it, but I think it should come live in 2026. And I would look for project manager who is not here to correct me if I'm wrong. So with that, the next steps we've got is hopefully in April come to you for approval of the historian contract. And I missed it on this slide, but hopefully I'll come to you with looking for approval of an engineering design services contract. And then the next quarterly update in June. Happy to take any questions. Yeah.
Questions for John? Yeah.
I have no more questions.
Great. You know, the VVO thing really excites me.
Oh, good.
So,
good.
It all excites me. But the idea that we can adjust the voltage at the end of a line and help us through a tight spot is just fascinating technology.
That's going to be great.
Yeah.
Excellent job, Jay, Juan, and Kevin.
Ouch.
Next up is our Energy Services 2024 program results with Jeff Feinberg and gang. Amazing team.
Good morning, commissioners. Jeff Feinberg, Senior Manager of Energy Services. And co-presenting with me will be Missy Wilch, and she can introduce herself when she comes up. But I would also be remiss if I didn't say that what I'm doing here today is I'm sharing the results of our team. And so I wanted to also acknowledge that we do have a lot of our team in the room, both online and in person, because A, if you guys ask really tough questions, I want to be able to pass it over to them so that they can actually answer it. But B, I think, you know, a big part of what we're doing today is really celebrating our results and what we've achieved. And I think it's really important that you know the who that delivered the what. And so maybe team energy services people, can you guys stand up and let them know who you are? And now we're going to introduce ourselves. This isn't all of us, but this is a lot of us. And I just think that as we talk about these results, again, there's a lot for us to be proud of, both from a regulatory compliance, fiscal responsibility standpoint, but there's just so much day-to-day work that goes into how we deliver these programs, and this team lives and breathes it. And so I just wanted to make sure you could see their faces and maybe even get to pepper them with questions at some point. And so what I'll say is this is a very high-level overview. I know we're one of several really in-depth presentations that you guys are receiving today. And so our goal in this presentation was to kind of give you, I mean, it can almost be called like charts, and more charts. But we really wanted to give you guys a lot of data points that you would have with you in your packet. And then any level of detail you'd like to get underneath these, where we get down to program level information or measure level detail, we can always provide that. We can always come back and present on specific programs if you guys have interest. But what we wanted you to see is kind of this holistic view to start with, where our talking points kind of speak to the details. But again, feel free to ask me questions as we go throughout the presentation, and we will dig in. So the first focus of our presentation is to talk about energy efficiency. And really there's three reasons we do energy efficiency, and we'll talk about those kind of three value propositions and the results for 2024. Then I'll pass it over to Missy, and she'll share our energy assistance and energy burden reduction success of 2024. And then we'll talk about grant support, which has kind of become a really big piece of our work over the last couple of years. And there's some really fun results to share about that as well. Any questions before we jump right in? All right. So the first reason we do energy efficiency, the Energy Independence Act, and you'll recall back in 2007, this law was passed, and it requires utilities that serve greater than 25,000 customers to pursue 15% of electricity from renewable resources and all cost-effective conservation. So as a result of that, one of the things we do is every 2 years, really in conjunction with our friends in power supply and the IRP process, we conduct what's called a conservation potential assessment. What this does, this looks across our territory, across our customers, and the market, and it helps us determine how much conservation potential there is for the next 10-year window. We then take that information and we set 2-year targets that we file with the state. The state audits those targets to make sure that we're not kind of padding the numbers or making it easy on ourselves. And then we then use those 2-year targets to make sure that we've got the programs in place to deliver that kind of conservation and energy efficiency. What I'll say is, it's a really powerful tool. We can break things down to the residential, it comes to customer segments, to residential, commercial, industrial, agricultural, and it shows us what measures might actually be possible. It's a really great tool, and it's one of those things that's available on our website, and it's something that we use for our playbook as well. We're currently in the process right now of updating our 2025 CPA as a part of also the new IRP process as well. But it really helps us direct our savings and where we need to go to make sure that we've got the programs available so customers can take action. So how did we do? Well, happy to report that year 2024 is the first year of our current biennium. Our current biennium of that 2-year period is 24 and 25. And at the end of 2024, we actually hit 57% of our target. And so the total amount that we need for that 2-year period, we're above the 50% mark, which is always our goal whenever we're setting these targets. We achieved 15.9 million kWh. What you see here on the left is a pie chart. And Michael Coe, who helps prepare charts for me, hates pie charts, but they really tell a really great story. And so he reluctantly assisted me and built this one for us. What you can see here, and what I think is really important to call out, there's a lot in this pie chart, but there's so many of our programs that fit into that one pie slice that says all other programs. But two really key pieces here that I think are important is as we think about our savings that we generate, one of the things that's important to note is it really is our commercial and industrial customers that play a huge role in the savings that we deliver. Where volumetrically we might do more measures in the residential space, it really is these partnerships with our commercial and industrial customers that are so critical. And this isn't just a piece of what our team delivers, my team in energy services, but we work hand in hand with our folks in government affairs. We work hand in hand with Shelley Patterson's strategic partnerships team, the key accounts group. They help us also achieve these outcomes. We get nowhere without all the teamwork in that. Some of the other things that are listed in our other programs, our retail marketplace, which you guys are aware of, that's where our customers can kind of go online right then and there and make purchase decisions for energy efficient products. We're excited to be introducing dynamic rebates and going even further with that in 2025. That'll give us the ability to even look at maybe doing some tiered incentives for customers based on perhaps constrained grid circuits, perhaps socioeconomic status, things like that. We might be able to offer different enhanced rebates that can be sent directly to those customers if they meet certain criteria, so we can get even more tailored about the incentives that we offer those customers. Other things in there are income qualified weatherization, midstream HVAC. So a lot of different ways we get to these results. And that's one of the other key messages. It's not only do we get our results, but we do it with a full toolkit and program portfolio.
Yeah, what is midstream?
So midstream is going to be offering incentives at the manufacturer, at the distributor level. So downstream would be kind of the in-use customers making the purchase. Upstream is where we're trying to affect market and market transformation. And midstream is at the distributor level where, say, a contractor is going in and purchasing the equipment and then installing it on behalf of the customer.
And what is NEEA? I'm sorry.
NEEA, yeah. Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance. And so this is an organization that we both subscribe to individually, and it's part of what we pay for in our rates is membership. And they handle market transformation at the national and maybe even international level. So they work with, like, literally the manufacturers of certain equipment to change codes and standards and expectations around how to make that equipment the most efficient it can be. So we receive savings directly through our participation there, and we receive indirect savings as well that way.
Thank you.
Yeah. And several of our team members serve on different committees with me. I'm on the Regional Portfolio Advisory Committee. Carolyn's on the products committee.
Changed it to residential, but yeah.
Residential, yeah. So there's several other committees and we participate. So that gives us a seat at the table. So we're not just kind of passively receiving these savings, but we're also kind of participating in the decisions that NEA makes in order to achieve these.
Impressive, what a big piece of pie the lighting still is.
It is, and I'll say that is in the commercial space, and we also recognize that that is a piece of the pie that will not be there too much further into the future. And so as a result of that, let me just point to that last bullet point. New in 2025, we do have a residential new construction program that we're really excited about, that you're soon going to see a bigger piece of the pie. And we also have developed a data center and telecom program because we know that this is a current need, but we also know that this is going to be an expanding need into the future. And rather than wait until these are already in and try to do even more costly retrofits, we've got a great partner who's out there trying to see where people are already looking to come in and bring in these data centers and make sure that they go in as energy efficient as possible from the outset, both saving the customers money, but also helping us anticipate the needs. So, you know, that's one of the big things that I can't say enough. Like, it's really fun to get to share these results with you guys. And what happens for us in energy efficiency is we finish December, we look at the numbers, and we go, thank goodness we hit the target. Now what's next? And we immediately move on and we look at where we're at with regard to the biennium. And we also look at where we're at with regard to what we have to accomplish over the next 10 years. Because, you know, we could start a program tomorrow and we don't usually start receiving savings, right? But if we want to get savings from a program next year, we've probably got to get that program launched very quickly this year. And so our team's kind of always looking at what's new and what's next and how we make sure that we've got things in place to take advantage of that so our customers can respond. Next, another way to talk about our Energy Independence Act results. This is just a historical look at how we've done. And so these are different bienniums. And the really key piece here, there's two things I want to call out on this slide. The left side is the target that we set and we filed with the state. The right side for each of these bienniums is what we've achieved. And you can see that historically, we have always overachieved our targets. And you might ask, why would we do that? Is it still cost effective when we do that? And the answer is yes. So one of the things we claim whenever we're claiming savings, it is first year savings. Many of the efficiency steps that we put in place, these measures, they're going to deliver savings well beyond the first year, but it's the first year savings that we claim. Michael Coe and Court Palmer are currently working on a piece right now to look at our 45-year history of conservation and to come up with some really cool numbers to kind of show the cumulative effect of the work that we've done. So that's coming soon, and it's going to be really interesting to look at. But so one reason we overachieve is because it's most affordable now. The second reason, and this is a really important one, and becoming more important day by day, is if for any reason we were ever to fall short of our Energy Independence Act goals, rather than be subject to fine, we can look to the two previous bienniums, and anything that we've overachieved, we can actually draw off that bank up to 20% of our current need. And I call that out because that is not something we've ever had to do before. We're not in imminent danger of that, but we are seeing some of our regional peers start to have to take that action and have to rely on some of that historical overachievement in order to kind of meet the current needs. And so knowing that, knowing the way the market works, and one of the slides I'm going to show you here in a minute, how costs have continued to rise, that's another increasingly important thing for us, is to overachieve when we can, because who knows when we might be able to draw off that to take care of our compliance goals.
I do have a question on the information that you're now putting together for historical purposes. You know, what does it look like in terms of our savings? Does that mean that will carry over into information on what that has saved the utility in terms of megawatts or whatever it is?
Yeah.
Because that's part of our thing of shading the peak and.
Definitely. And part of how we're telling the story is we're trying to look at all these different numbers and try to think, what are some of the really creative things we can kind of show of, and, you know, here's the overall value. And it's a difficult thing, right? Because some measure life is 4 years, some measure life is 20 years, right? But we're kind of doing the best we can to kind of come up with some cool approximations so that we can kind of tell that story in a really profound way. Because it's, I mean, again, it's, we're not just a leader here in the community, but we are a regional leader in the way we've done this work. And it's made a substantial impact, not just on our community, but the region.
But it has in terms of our customer bills. It has saved us a whole lot of money. Well, it's in terms, well, we may be getting into a lot more expensive stuff, but it there is a savings for the customer. And over time, it's pretty significant.
Yeah, both customer and obviously and us.
Right.
Huge savings. Yeah. I'll be anxious to see those numbers as well. Jeff and team had provided me, I think, a 10-year look back in the amount of savings, both from kilowatt hours as well as the dollars, and it was significant. It is significant.
Okay. We're going to talk about reimbursement here in just a minute, too. Any questions about this before we move? So this one isn't to inspire fear, but it's to show reality. And I think that this one's really important. So when we look at the cost per kilowatt hour, and this is, again, at the program portfolio level. So this is the whole pie, right, of everything we're doing in energy efficiency. The important thing to note here is, yeah, historically, for about a decade or more, we did see that the cost per kilowatt hour kind of stayed around that 20 cents per kilowatt hour. However, post-pandemic, we're really seeing things kind of stabilize at about 30 cents per kilowatt hour at the portfolio level. And again, our team is constantly looking at these numbers and how we balance the portfolio level view by thinking what other kind of cost-effective savings can we bring in, because we certainly have more expensive programs that have a lot of other values beyond energy efficiency savings alone, such as income qualified weatherization, where maybe we might see $1.50 per kilowatt hour, but that's a strategically important customer subset that we need to serve. But then we can buffer against that with things like strategic energy management, where maybe we're paying 5 cents a kilowatt hour for those savings. So our team is kind of constantly looking at what's available, what's the cost per kilowatt hour at a program level, and then how does that roll into the portfolio to help us balance this. But it's also to show that energy efficiency is not immune from inflation like everything else. And because we've been so historically successful at the low-cost, no-cost energy efficiency, now we're having to turn our attention to a little bit of the more expensive measures.
But excuse me.
Go ahead.
In terms of the earlier years, we were looking at low-hanging fruit.
Very much so.
Low-hanging.
very much. So residential lighting was a huge, huge piece. And, you know, codes and standards have caught up, the market's caught up, which is what we want to happen, right? We want energy efficiency to be the baseline. And that's really what's happened with residential lighting, right? So when we look at residential programs now, the ones that have the most value are things like water heating, they're things like larger appliances, heat pumps, things like that, which you can imagine are quite a bit more expensive than lighting.
I have a comment or question. It gave my attention that since 2015 to 2020, looks like the average for cost per kilowatt maintained very much the same, right? I mean, like 20 cents or 21 or 19. And then the increase in 2022 is like, something. Yes.
Yeah.
Do you know why?
So it really is that measure mix.
Okay.
So when we look back at kind of those times, there was a lot more residential lighting, which again, incentivizing those sort of measures. It doesn't take much to change the market between making the purchase decision, say, for like an incandescent bulb versus LEDs. It didn't take much. Now, those opportunities are less. And the opportunities that really are in front of us are trying to incentivize more efficient, say, HVAC equipment, really large building efficiency projects that are going to be a little bit more expensive for us to move the needle and get customers to take that action to go a little bit more efficient with us.
And the second question is that 2022 is 32 cents and then went down in 2023. That was for COVID, or you give a relief to the customers, or?
No, that just has to do with our measure mix. And you know, you'll always see a little bit of fluctuation between 1 and 5 cents. I would say at the portfolio level, I mean, you can kind of see it's usually about 3 cents. And it really just kind of depends what programs customers are choosing to take advantage of and which ones they're not. And again, what we're trying to always look at is just how do we keep it as balanced as we can, and how do we make sure that this rise isn't as dramatic? But again, I think this speaks mostly to the fact that a lot of what historically was very low cost and easy for us to achieve, we've kind of saturated that part of what's in the energy efficiency space. And now what we're having to do is be really creative to think about how do we double the value proposition for customers as things get more expensive. We at least the utility can say, okay, maybe we're paying a little bit more, but we're also getting some opportunities for demand response, grid harmonization. We're getting things to be able to look at strategic segments of customers that maybe we haven't served or were underserved in the past, and how do we serve them more effectively. Maybe we have to pay a little bit more for that, but it's the right thing to do because we can achieve it maybe places we haven't yet.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So Jeff, these costs, so we'll take the 34 cents. So that's the kilowatt hour, that's the cost of the kilowatt hour in the first year?
That's the incentive we're paying.
Okay.
That's the amount of incentive we're paying to get that piece of savings, okay. If that makes sense,
okay.
In the first year.
But most of these measures will last at least 10 years, if not probably 20 years or so.
Yeah. And we're kind of constantly having that conversation at the regional level, and a lot of the committees and work groups that we talk about is, and we report first-year savings, and that's kind of how we think of this work. Very few of these measures are one-year measures. And so there really is an enduring benefit to the utility. And, you know, our friends in Power Supply do a really good job of helping to tell that story, too, when they're, like, when you talk about the contract that we're going to be talking about a little later in the meeting, and just kind of the value of conservation over time. Yeah.
Thank you.
I knew this one was going to sort of inspire, like, but we have to talk about it because we're going to come with our budget, right? And you're going to keep saying, well, why are they the third largest budget? And there's a reason we're the third largest budget. However, good news. Not only do we take a lot of this district funds and invest it, but that's exactly what it is. It is an investment. So one of the reasons we do energy efficiency, the regulatory outcomes we just talked about. Another reason is because a part of what we pay for in rates is regional conservation. And BPA allows us for any of the conservation that we fund to pursue reimbursement for that if it fits the BPA qualifications for savings. And I'm happy to report that on average, you can see here from 2014 all the way through, we typically bring back 70% of every dollar that we spend on energy efficiency through this EEI reimbursement. And we always want to call it out because we want to make sure it's really clear that when we're putting this money in customers' hands, while we're collaborating with customers on these projects, that it is not just a spend like other, say, infrastructure spend can be, but rather we do receive this reimbursement benefit from ETA.
You're not going to put this question. Aren't we already sending, isn't that our money that's coming back from the EPA? We're paying it in emergency.
Yeah.
Okay, that's all for me. Sorry, that's a real cool spot for me.
We're still getting it back.
I know.
We're not getting it back.
Okay, we're getting some of it back.
Yes.
70%. Sorry, I can't get that out.
Well, I think the thing that's so phenomenal about between this program, the other program, and the Northwest is just unique in really holding the amount of energy needed pretty flat. I mean, I think people were shocked when they look at all the apartments that are getting built in our area, and our load is still flat,
yeah.
And it's all through conservation.
I have a full comment, Commissioner Tony. So are we going to continue to get the reimbursement for the VPA, our money, even though with all these changes, the impact and VBS affected by? So
if this is passing the buck, let me know. But what I'll say is I do know a little bit later today, Garrison's team is presenting on the post-2028 BPA contract, and I know that that's one of the particular items that we will address in that conversation. And so can we defer that question until then? Is that okay?
Okay, thank you.
I think it's a good answer, though, or you can look forward to the answer. But again, one other thing I want to call out on this slide that I think is really important. The savings that we claim for Washington State, those go by certain guidelines, rules, and specs. Some of the savings we claim for BPA are the same, and some of the savings we have to claim for BPA require different specs, rules, and measurements and verification. Again, this is some of the great work that our team does, where they're kind of constantly looking at savings and measures that they want to bring into programs, and they're saying, well, what are the implications for the way we can claim it for the state? What are the implications for the way we might need to claim it for BPA reimbursement? And how do we do both or either and know when we're making those decisions? And so again, it's just part of the refined way that this team does the work that I think is really important as they're always thinking about the ratepayers and how do we make sure that the return on this investment is exactly what we expect. So with that, we just move on to one quick slide that talks about, one quick slide that talks about, again, the third big piece of the value proposition of energy efficiency. So one, it's the law. Good news. We're well on our way to taking care of the 24-25 results. The fiscal piece, good news. We're well on our way to staying course and claiming 70% of that back from BPA. And then the third reason is we just always want to call out that on the demand side, we are the least cost resource that the IRP continues to point to. And so it's a really important thing that we remember that energy efficiency is power supply at the end of the day. And so we are the light blue. This is a chart we love. We look forward to seeing what the 2025 IRP update presents in terms of conservation and cumulative EE that we need to produce. But we're always happy to be partnering with that power supply team to make sure that we get what they expect so that it helps them balance the rest of the resource mix as they acquire that. So are there any further questions on these EE results?
You know, I just want to say something, summarize on this, and that is, we have guests in the audience. So the story is it's cheaper to help people conserve energy than it is to build new generating resources.
Or to buy them power.
Or to buy it on the market. That's correct. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jeff. And one other piece. This is net of the BPA reimbursement, right? So that's where it actually shows up on here. That 70% we're getting back is the net cost for those kilowatt hours paid. Or kilowatt hours not having to be purchased, and that's where it shows up, and that's what drives it to being the least cost, next least cost resource for us.
So with that, I'm going to pass things over to Missy, and she's going to talk a little bit about our energy assistance results before I come back.
Hi, I don't know how I can follow that. Betsy Wilch, Energy Assistance Program Manager. I'm responsible for looking at different ways that we can reduce energy burden for our income qualified customers in Snohomish County. Might be a little nervous, so just bear with me here. All right, first I wanted to just do a quick reminder. I think we presented to you this in June. This is just a reminder of the CETA Act, which clean energy transformation and the carve out that we have for energy assistance. Just a reminder, this was passed in 2019, 2020, when we started reporting. And essentially what it changed for us is how we measure, track, and report all of the information directly to CETA. And they've included targets for us. So the big takeaway, especially for you, that I want you to take a look at is that second bullet point down on the bottom there. Utilities must develop targets to understand the cost to reduce energy burden in vulnerable customers. We have to be meeting 60% by 2030 and 90% by 2045. So these are direct targets that we have to be obtaining.
Is that the percentage of the ones we can identify?
Yeah, I think there's still some question on how to identify. Yes, that's always the big question. So
90% is a pretty big number.
It is a very big number. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any other questions? So I wanted to give you a quick recap on some of the work that we've been doing in regards to the income qualified discount program. When we were here in June, we were 1 month into after we launched the online application. This is the one chart I have on this. You can see we sort of averaged 12,000, 11,000, 12,000 for years. May of 2024 is when we launched the online application. As of January 1st, 2025, we were bumped up to 15,000 and we are steadily growing. That's 127% increase in our actual participation into the income qualified discount program. I also want to call out that we've had a 262% increase in Spanish applications because the online application we have, the people have the ability to convert it into Spanish. It's much easier for them to do. Just another barrier broken down. We also added some streamlined enrollment options and we've increased public events. I really want to call out the quote on the bottom here because this is a senior and a mother of a PUD employee who's been very vocal about us not having an online application and they were super happy. So
I have a question. I'm just curious. When you are outside in public events, because at the bullet point is an increase in public events, what are the common questions the more often the people ask regarding the PUD or regarding discounts? So
it's typically about eligibility when we're out there at public events. I think it probably depends on the audience and where we're at. The events that we've tried to target are the ones where we can reach some of our vulnerable customers. For example, one of them we did was down at the Village in Linwood. A high amount of participation. I actually have another slide in regards to this, so I'll get a little bit more into that here in a second.
Thank you.
Yeah. So that's the work that we've done with the Income Qualified Discount Program. Oh, here's our next slide. So thank you for the lead. I appreciate that. We did attend 19 events between April and December of 2024. Of those 19 events, we also attended, this is included in the 19, 7 back-to-school events, which was quite the task. We really did try to keep count on the amount of customers that we've seen at those events, but they were really busy. So we're estimating it was a direct assistance to about 60 families between filling out, so we had laptops at the events, able to fill out surveys for customers. It's time for the CCA grant, which in turn put people on the radar for the HERS program, or directly help them with a discount application. So wildly successful. We also dedicated, as Jeff told you guys last year, we're going for the seniors. So we went to a 55 plus complex. We teamed up directly with energy assistance at Snohomish County. So we sat at a tabling event. We sat there the whole day with them and people just came up and we filled out their applications, and the customers were able, we did 26 customers. They were able to get the grants directly from EAP, pass the information to us, and then we could go ahead and get them enrolled in the discount program, all live on the spot. They walked away knowing what they had on their account, which is pretty fantastic. And they were super happy. I've already had two other complexes reply back and say, hey, we need you here. So this is good. So we're going to continue that focus with community agencies and interests in the events. I really want to point out the bottom, the enhancing capabilities, the ILA devices. They just came in last week. They're translation devices, and they are fantastic. One of my community events that I went to this last year, it was at a Edmonds school district. And what it is, I really wish I had one of the devices so I could show you, but it's a two-sided device, kind of like a, you know, a phone. You hit the button on this side, you talk into it, and it translates on the other side. So you have a live conversation with somebody. It's seamless. I was able to test it at a school event and have a full conversation with somebody in German. And I tell you, I know no German at all. It was fantastic. I really think this is going to break down barriers. So we ordered three of those devices, and we're going to have them available for checkout. So people that are going to community events, we can have a focus on making sure that we have language accessibility for everybody.
Well, as a person that my primary language is Spanish, I really appreciate that you have this kind of device and that closing the gap in order that people that only speak English can apply. And I really appreciate that you guys are very intentional.
I had at that event that I was at, that Edmonds event, I happened to have a Spanish speaker with me at that particular location. And she got on the device and she looked at it and just to see if it had the different, I think it's dialects. So I believe she's from Peru. So she got on there and it was there. So there's over 400 languages and we can customize certain things that we need to in there. It's pretty slick. So
thank you.
Yeah.
I've got a question. So you're in a back to school event. Can you, they're signing families up for free and reduced lunch. Are we able to import that or they can co-apply, check a box?
Yep. With the online application, we now have the ability, we send a little scanner, like a little tabletop scan one page through. And I've been working with the schools to make sure that they're promoting to people, because typically the back to school events, the customers don't walk to the events with that unless they know that we're going to be there.
Right.
They get that letter in the middle of the summer before the event happens. So if somebody doesn't have it, I have business cards that I've created with the QR code so people can just go home and do it right when they get home. But we have the active conversations to make sure that they know where to get it.
Thank you.
Welcome. Any other questions on this slide? So how do we measure up in 2024? I really am just going to focus on the information over on the left margin there. For CETA, we identified the funding need at $15.3 million. As of 2023, we hit about 60%, we exceeded 60%, $9.5 million. Just as a reminder, the primary target for energy assistance is approximately 22,000 high-burden customers. 50% of those customers have high-burden, high-efficiency potential that are best served by conservation and weatherization programs. I have to call out the income qualified weatherization block there. A lot of the work that we're doing, and you know, we've tried to turn the dials to figure out where we can maximize all of our information. And you guys seen in our last presentation the information about income qualified. That we are getting to more whole home improvements, which goes back to Jeff's slide, the fancy slide that he had, slide six. These whole home improvements that we're putting into these homes, that's lasting. Those are 30 and 40 year measures with lasting savings. So I just want to make sure that I'm calling that out. That's all I have for my slide. Do you guys have any questions for me?
I'm just curious if we are going to continue to receive grants in order to provide more
relief to the customers and now. I know it's
Jeff. He's on the next slide anyway. No, you're great.
I'm sorry, it's a challenge there outside right now, actually, right? So that's the reason I asked.
It is, yeah. And so what I can say, specifically as it relates to things like weatherization and the LIHEAP program, we both participate at the local. Kim's team is acting on our behalf at the federal level to make sure that we advocate for these really important federal programs. I'll say, you know, in the 7 years I've been around even the LIHEAP program, that's been a few different administrations, and that is historically one that Congress always kind of picks up and talks about. And it's one that's always maintained because I think that we can really show the data behind why it matters in the homes that it serves. So I will, it all remains to be seen at this point, but I'll say we are very aggressive in the ways that we continue to advocate and make sure that our electeds and our team has all the numbers that they need so that they can support what the story for things like LIHEAP and weatherization is in Snohomish County. So that's kind of a broad answer. But one of the other things our team does do is we're kind of constantly on the lookout and working with the government affairs team to look for other local grants that we might be able to pursue. And that is the last thing we're going to talk about. And so just really quickly wanting to share some of the really fun things we got to do in 2024 as it relates to grants. You guys will recall the Climate Commitment Act. It's a cap and invest law that was passed in 2021. And it was on the ballot in the fall of 24, and it was maintained. And it focuses on greenhouse gas emissions, but basically what it does is those fines go into an auction, and then they become available to be used for burdened, overburdened, and vulnerable communities. And so as a result of that, back in the summer of last year, we were able to distribute clean energy bill credits that were funded through that grant program. We distributed 71,687 bill credits to low and moderate income families. What I want to say about this that's so cool, so $14.34 million is how much we brought to the community. We were allowed to take a substantial amount of that and leverage it for administrative costs. I believe all said and done, between marketing, outreach, admin, we only used, I want to say, less than $90,000 for admin costs by repurposing other processes and things we already had in place, so that then anything we didn't need for admin, we could roll into additional grants for families here in the community.
That's phenomenal. In terms of the traditional pattern, administrative overhead, I'm so amazed by that. That's tough.
I appreciate you saying that, because what I'll say is, like, that only happens because our team works across, it's a cross-divisional thing, right? It's customer accounting, general accounting, it's corporate communications, it's energy services, it's customer service, and it's everybody getting together to go, how do we make this happen and do it in the most efficient way possible? And government affairs, right? Like, there's so many people involved in how we did that. And the other thing that I think is so cool, so of that 14.34, right, we could have the admin dollars, and then we had to give $200 whole bill credits. We only turned $689 back in of the amount that they gave us. I'm so proud of that. And of that 689, I want to say 400 of it were people at the last minute saying we didn't want our grant and giving it back. So again, it just shows you the tremendous work ethic of our team and our people to say, how else can we bring these dollars into our community? How do we keep these dollars here and make sure that we're doing it? And so really proud of the way that program rolled up. And then the next one I want to talk about is our HERES program. It's the Home Electrification and Appliance Rebates. This one we launched back in November. We have a hard deadline of June 30th, 2025, as it stands right now. We were awarded $5.3 million. And I've got even more updated numbers than the slide. As of this morning, I'm happy to report that we've actually served 610 households. So beyond the 472. And what I want to call out here again is we could have done this program a lot of different ways. Things that are eligible under this program are, say, like heat pump retrofits and that sort of thing. When we looked at the $5.3 million available, and we know the considerable need we have in Snohomish County for our folks that are energy burdened but also have energy efficiency potential, we thought there are still some really meaningful measures that we can do that cost less than heat pump retrofits, so we'll be able to serve a lot more households. So we decided we were going to focus on induction cooking. We were going to focus on Energy Star washing machines and heat pump dryers, and we were going to be focused on heat pump water heaters. And so because of that, it made the path a lot more difficult for our team. Looking at Carolyn, John Potosa, Allison Grenzel, so many different members of our team that have been working on this. But what it's allowed us to do is to serve more households. If we would have gone for heat pumps, that $5.3 million would have probably been used up in less than 100 households. At this point, we're already over 600 households, and I think when it's all said and done, we're going to serve over 1,200 households. And these 1,200 households are basically getting savings that will last well on into the next 5 to 10 years and provide really meaningful benefits on their annual savings. So I just share that to say I can't wait till this program ends in June and we get to come back in the summer and we get to tell this story, because this is an even cooler story. When we talk about the heat pump water heater contractors and the way four of them have come together and they set profit aside to participate in this program in the ways we ask them to and some of the benefits we're seeing, it's a really cool story and we can't wait to share that. When we talk about appliance retailers that we intentionally chose to be local because we wanted to keep these dollars in the local community and the way that's turned things around, it's another really cool story. So this is just a partial teaser of, hey, we're working on it and we can't wait to tell you more. So with your permission, we'll be back hopefully in the near future to kind of tell that. And we're also holding out hope in the hopes that during the budget process, this gets extended and maybe even gets funded further and becomes a bigger piece of what we're doing. But again, just an example of how this team rallies and figures out how to get it done. So
way to establish a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
I don't know if it should be there.
He got his zinger in for the budget, too. Sorry.
Questions?
Very, very sharp.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Missy. Exciting program.
Great job, Jeff and Missy.
Now, why don't we take a short break? Why don't we break and come back? It's 10:26. Let's come back at 10:35. 10:35, and we're back.
All right, next up is our Connect Up quarterly update, and Tim Epp.
Morning, Tim. Morning, Don. Morning, commissioners. My name is Tim Epp. I'm the AMI program director here for another quarterly update, although it's actually been 6 months since our last official update, so a bit overdue, but glad to be back. So just an informational update for the board today, and I'm going to keep things moving pretty quickly because I know you heard it full morning.
Is Commissioner Alvarado Crosby familiar at a very high level of what Connect Up is?
The
I got a smile.
It's not, yes, I'm okay.
Okay. Sorry about that.
So maybe I'll give a brief. AMI stands for Advanced Metering Infrastructure, and this is a project to put new smart meters, electronic meters that do two-way communication and allow us to measure more information going on at the house, voltage, current, things like that, and then transmit that information back to the district in a timely manner. And I'll tie some of that back in later on in the discussion with some of our previous presentations that the system helps out with. So overall, we'll give you an update on the overall program status, talk about our deployment status of the meters and our AMI network as well. We'll talk about an upcoming milestone for the program. And then I wanted to take a little time today to talk about the bomb cyclone and how that impacted the AMI system and how that played out. And then we'll give an update on Connect Up 2.0. That's AMI beyond the business case, if I can end with that. So overall, we're still tracking pretty close to our original budget, overall program budget. And one thing that we are seeing is our meter vendor is projecting a very strong meter supply to be picking up. So I know I've got getting my hopes up, but trying to keep that a bit tempered. But they have projected to send us a total of 215,000 meters in 2025, with a balance to come then by mid-year next year. By end of second quarter, we should have all of our meters if they follow through on that projection. Water, we are expecting to get the balance of the water meters in this year as well. So that'll be another 14,000 meters that should be coming in. But I will say meter supply continues to be one of my top concerns in terms of, you know, being able to meet that or meet our program deadlines, our program targets for finishing up. The other concern that I've got right now, you've heard about tariffs, I'm sure, in the news. And so that is something that is potentially impacting our system. All of our electric meters are manufactured in Mexico, and there are some impacts to water meters. So water meters are subject, we've been notified, to a 1% tariff, and that works out to about $15,000 then for the balance of our meters coming in. So not too big of an impact on that side. On the electric side, if we got hit with a full 25% tariff, that would come out to about $7 million. So yeah, substantial, that's a substantial impact.
I have a question. So if, I mean, for the potential import for the tariffs, so that price is going to increase, right? I mean, it was like how much it was before and how much is going to change?
So 25% tariff, let's see. There are different meters that have different prices. The meter that we have the most of is about a $75 meter, so a 25% increase on that.
Okay. Jim, does the $93.2 million budget include the contingency that we approved?
It does not. So there is, you know, we have that, you know, kind of set aside. John never likes us planning on contingency, so be careful with what I say here, but...
Be freely, Tim.
Yeah, yeah, thanks. Yeah, so that would still keep us within that contingency amount if things are trending like they are at the 90 million. So the 90 million projected is not with the tariff rate factored in. And we don't know what we will actually see for a tariff amount. That hasn't been published. We've seen water meter. I've seen some gas meter numbers. The gas meter's not the full 25, hopefully not that full amount if it does come.
And so our contract on the electric side of the house for meters wasn't a fixed price.
The meter, the meter price is fixed. The vendor is attaching this as a separate fee.
But we are not just rolling over.
No, I know that.
Colin and team are engaged in the process.
I like that engaged in the process a lot. Any other questions?
Okay, so on our meter deployment status, updated numbers fresh this morning, electric is at 50,000 installed. So a little bit better than when I actually put the slide deck together for getting ready for this morning. We are seeing our rate of installs starting to pick up, and that is a factor of having meters to install and then also getting enough installers. So we're in the process of ramping up our hiring to correspond to the increase in meter supply that we're expecting. So our target is to be at 4,000 meters a week to be installed by July. Water at 14,000 installed, they are, yeah, it's over 60% installed. They are still working staffing levels. So they've got the meter supply well in hand, but they're installation rate is a factor of staffing, which they're working on getting up to their full staffing level. Opt-out rate is holding pretty steady at that 0.3% level. I did add something, though, the effective rate, and that is a factor of the number of people who drop out of the opt-out. So they go back into a full meter read situation with electronic reads. So effectively, we're at 0.23%. Of customers opted out.
So even though they've only had their meters for a time, they've already opted in.
Yeah.
Do we know we keep track of the reasons for opt-out, or do we collect that information?
I don't believe that we do. Another thing, last time I was here, we talked about running a pilot on dropping our two-week notice postcard. We were finding anecdotally that it was not really effective, and it was actually creating an extra constraint on our deployment planning efforts. After the conclusion of 3 months of not running the postcard, we found that it was of no impact whatsoever to our customer satisfaction numbers for the process. So we're going to keep that opted out, or keep that turned off. If we find that's an issue later on, we can turn that back on. Got a map on there. You can see where the green is where we have deployed. White is where we're going to be moving into, as well as the pink. That's another area that we're staging and getting ready to do. We plan to move up the Highway 9 corridor, up the east side of Highway 9 for the balance of the year, people making our way to other parts of the county.
I have a question, sorry, my ignorance, but this delay for the meters that impact to a new constructions, like if I'm building my home and I have to wait for the meter coming or something, so I want to picture that. So people that are in like development or building right now, they are impacted by this delay for the meters?
No, so we actually hold enough contingency of meters to handle new construction or repairs so that, yeah, we make sure there's always a meter ready.
Okay, thank you.
What are the lines on the picture? Are those the stones?
Those are meter reading routes.
Okay.
So that is how we do our deployment to make it easier on our meter reading and our billing processes to make sure we get a whole route knocked out at one time.
Makes sense.
So our AMI network is almost deployed. We're working through the last two base station sites to be installed. We actually backed down one. We found that after evaluating network coverage, we were able to remove one of them and save the district a little bit of money over time. So these last two are the most challenging ones to complete. They both have really tough permitting processes to work through, but I don't see any issue with us getting that wrapped up for this year. All right. So bomb cyclone, I do want to talk about our, I skipped. Yeah. There we go. Thank you. We do have a project milestone coming up, and that was something once we hit our 10% deployment mark, we are going to be doing some testing with some more rigorous testing with our vendor to make sure that everything is operating the way that it's supposed to. Because this program has been drawn out a little bit longer, a lot longer than it should have been, I actually am less, I'm not really concerned that we're going to face anything, any issues here that would be a surprise. So if we do, the vendor though will be on the hook to resolve any of those performance or functional issues. So bomb cyclone. So one of the nice things about AMI is that you can think of it as a sensor network. So a sensor out on every home and business in the county. And so this bomb cyclone gave us a chance to kind of see how things would perform in a very stressful situation. We had, over 18,000 meter outages recorded within that first day that the storm hit. And then over the next 5 days, that number grew even more. We also got to see our base stations and how they performed. So some of them were knocked out of power. They all have battery backup systems, and those batteries lasted for a while. They actually performed better than expected. But because of the length of the storm, this was a 7-day storm, 13 of those base stations did go offline. Got an animation here to show you, and this is kind of a playback of where those meters were going out as time went on. So the red, when you see a red pop, that's a meter going out, and the green flash as that comes back on, that is the meter being restored to power. So this is a kind of a nice playback to understand how the storm progressed. If you zoom in quite a bit on this, I know we don't have the ability here, but you'll be able to see that we actually have meters all over the county. They're just more densely populated on that Highway 2 corridor and kind of that southeast corner of the district service territory. So some lessons that we learned as a result of this. Let's get to the next slide.
It is interesting to see the thing we've always discussed where we repair something,
yeah,
back out again.
Yes.
Yeah.
It does happen.
Yeah.
So one of the lessons, it was a good reminder that AMI is a lossless communication system. It's one of our consultants. That was one of the first things that he stressed to us. Lossy. We like the term. And so we build in a lot of redundancies, but there are still times when the system is going to get stressed beyond what it is built for. And so not all commute meters get to communicate, especially when there's a lot of traffic going on. Meter ping performance, we know, struggled during this. But I think one of the best things was it was very useful for us to see before we leave an area where meters might still be out of power, to make sure that we get all of our customers cleaned up back online. And so that's a feature that we have never had before, and looking forward to having this broadly throughout the county.
So when the meter loses power, it has that last desperate ping, gives up.
Last gasp.
And what you're saying is that overloaded the communication system. Is there any kind of automated system that can go back in and ping all meters or other meters to know whether ones that didn't get reported were out?
Yes. So our OMS system actually has that capability to do broad pinging. But even some of that, so what it did is our system automatically pings. But when you're restoring a lot of whole circuits at a time, that was thousands of meters getting pinged back at a time. And so that ended up overloading the system as well. So that's some of the lessons that we're learning about how the system operates and how maybe we can temper that a little bit. So we're working on adjustments to that. But I do want to say that our current outage management system has some limitations that are going to hold us back until we get our next AMS. So we're really looking forward to having SnowSmart up and running. We think that that's going to be a really strong partner's technology with us, give us more control over those kinds of scenarios.
Obviously, this isn't a challenge that's unique to us. Have other utilities come up with a solution to?
Yeah, I think
a larger amount.
Yeah, we're actually. I would. This is my personal characterization. A little surprised by our current OMS vendors' lack of configuration ability in that realm. So we're having to build some buffer in between to do our own mitigation of those issues.
So from one of the solutions, is it going to be that the fact that we delay restoration of power because we want to make sure that we don't have this congestion problem? Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
And actually, I think the long term, it will help expedite restoration efforts.
Okay.
Give us better data coming from the field.
Yeah, the level of situational awareness we'll have about what's going on in the grid is just improved that much more. All right, and then a little bit of connect up beyond the business case. These are the things that we're working on that go beyond just what we said we would do with the system to pay for itself. Self-serve data. You heard about the historian in the SnowSmart. This is something similar that we're working on to make sure that anybody in the district who needs all the information coming back from the meters has that at their fingertips and can make use of it. One group that's working on that example is our system planning department. So we're working on finalizing a data feed for them to do system planning work with AMI meter data. We made a change, an update to MySnowPUD. So now not only does it show kilowatt hours for each interval, but customers can flip it and see it in dollars and cents. So a little less abstract, a little more concrete, more meaningful to our customers as they're looking at their interval usage. Outage, I mentioned some of this with the bomb cyclone, but it's been great for nested outage information. And then we're also mitigating some of the limitations of our current system. You heard from Jeff and about some of our opportunities that are getting more and more challenging to identify on conservation. And this is where AMI is gonna come in and help out with providing more detailed information for Jeff and team to identify those potential opportunities as those opportunities become harder and harder to find. Transformers, we're constantly watching the grid, making sure that our transformers aren't overloaded with between electric vehicles and electrification. And so this is a report that allows our engineers to keep a close eye on that. And then I'll mention SnowSpark support. In addition to some of the OMS things, we are also the network communication support for John Heap's grid devices. So all of that will be provided through the AMI network that we've already set up. So those are some of the highlights.
Questions?
I'll just say that I love the interval data.
Beautiful.
And I noticed that the cost data is there, and I can see the impact of not having LED Christmas lights. I can see when I've left the lights on in my crawl space. I mean, that's how fine-tuned you can really get to. Do you have any success stories? You've had some on water. We found some leaks. How about on the electric side?
Our biggest success story I would point to would certainly be the outage and being able to see more detailed outage information and finding nested outages. Mm-hmm. In terms of maybe conservation yet.
Well, I was thinking like the dangerous electrical bases that were located or earth theft we've talked about.
We're working on a tamper report still. So that tamper report is in process right now. It's not up and running yet, but we're making some progress on that. So dangerous situations. Fortunately, we have not had anything that's really popped out, and that's really encouraging that all those meter bases out there are in good shape.
Well, Commissioner,
yes,
you were talking about theft of power, by the customer.
Yeah, that was one of the things identified in the business case that this and the other green devices, we'd be able to identify some stealing power.
Correct. And I think what SnowSmart will put in place will be one more piece of that puzzle as well, helping to identify those.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, great
presentation. Excellent job, Tim. All right, next up is a transmission and resource rate making, or remarketing, and Ian Hunter. Good morning, Ian.
Morning, John. Good morning, commissioners. I'm Ian Hunter. I'm a power analyst from the Power Supply Group. We're going to talk today a little bit about our transmission resource remarketing efforts. This is an update. We had a previous briefing back in January to kind of kick off the process. So we're just going back to you to give a little bit of an update on where we're at. And I think Jeff Feinberg said his presentation was charts, 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 and this presentation is words, words, words. So, you know, you get a little bit of everything today. What we're hoping to do is just provide that update that I mentioned. We're going to talk a little bit about the review of what we've actually offered in our request for offers. We're going to talk where we're at in the RFO process and then what our expected next steps are. And there's no decision from the commission today. So a little bit of review and refresher. As we transition to a new Bonneville Power Administration power and transmission product, there's certain parts of our portfolio that are going to be surplus to our needs. And so those that are surplus to our needs are available for us to remarket back out into the marketplace. As we do that, that helps keep our future flexibility available so that we can kind of keep some of those transmission assets in our portfolio, but still also keep costs low for our customers if we bring in revenues from assigning them for these periods where we don't need them. We solicited offers for our available asset portfolio on January 6th, and the period closed on January 30th. So just to go back over what we're actually offering as part of this RFO, on the power side, so these are generating resources, we have three wind power purchase agreements, Hay Canyon, Wheatfield, and White Creek. We have two small hydro resources, Hancock and Callaghan, that are offered on the power side. Our BPA contract actually allows these resources to return to load service in fiscal year 2029, which is why it's just for that 26 to 28 term. On the transmission side, we are transitioning to a network transmission product, which leaves some of our point-to-point available for remarketing. And that's about 550 megawatts across several different combinations of paths.
Point-to-point?
Yeah, absolutely. So network transmission is where you would say to Bonneville, here's my load. I want you to just take care of transmission service for it. And so Bonneville does the work to kind of make sure the transmission is planned for and that we have firm service available to serve our loads. Point-to-point service is where you go out to Bonneville and you say, I want transmission between point A and point B on the transmission system. So that can actually be used for remarketing if we want to sell surplus energy, for example, whereas network transmission is strictly to serve your load.
Thank you.
We also offered a bi-directional share of our Northwest AC Intertie, or the NWACI, as it's referred to, or the third AC. This is transmission that runs from Oregon down into California. We have 42 megawatts north to south capacity and 32 megawatts south to north. So it's kind of a transmission line gateway between the Northwest and California. What was the structure of the RFO? So it was open from January 6th to January 31st, as I mentioned. Bidders were allowed to provide offers on some or all of the available resources. We did structure it so that if they submitted a bid, it had to be on each particular asset individually. They couldn't come back and say, well, we're only going to take it if you offer us all of your wind and all of your transmission. You had to look at each kind of component separately. We had a respondents conference on January 16th so that if any interested party had questions, they could come to us and clarify anything in the offering or if there was any outstanding questions that they might have that might help inform their bids. We also had a set of written questions which came in and we answered all of them and made them available to all participants so that if one person asked a question via email, everyone could see the questions and see the response as well. What were the results? The exciting part. We received an unprecedented volume of offers across our available portfolio for more than a dozen counterparties. We developed an analysis framework to look at the highest value offers, both in terms of net present value, so how much value it's going to derive for us both now and through the future term of the assignment, and adjusting for varied duration sales. So some of the assets that we offered, we said you can bid on it for 3, 5, 10 years. So we had to do some comparative analysis if somebody wanted it for 3 years at a higher price or for 10 years at a slightly lower price. You know, what's the value of that certainty of the duration versus the revenue that you're getting immediately? So we developed this framework. We put the bids through it, and using that analysis, we identified and have contacted finalists for each of our offered resources. So all of the resources that were offered do have a finalist currently lined up. So next steps, negotiations are ongoing. So we don't wanna put anything out into the public space that could affect those negotiations. So we're not gonna be discussing specific prices or revenues today, except to say that we do anticipate that the combination of sales will result in a very significant benefit for our ratepayers and positive budget implications for the budget coming up. As we finalize those contracts with our counterparties, we would be bringing each of them to the commission for consideration, and we would also bring along with it a recommendation regarding its execution. So kind of a short update, but if there's any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Questions, commissioners?
I have a question regarding, I'm not going to ask the prices and nothing like that, but
again, the changes that exist at the federal level regarding electricity and power and all that, they are going to impact whatever portfolio or deals that you might start to do and since January 6 or January 30 till yeah. now.
Yeah.
There are going to be changes in the amount of money.
We don't anticipate any impacts coming from changes at the federal level. Most of our respondents were in the region here in the Northwest. And so because we're offering a portion of our own resources and resources that we have under kind of a tight contract with Bonneville, we don't anticipate changes at the federal level having an impact on the products that we're offering or the prices we would expect to receive.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great presentation.
Thank you.
We look forward to you bringing some revenue.
Us too.
Thank you.
Another teaser.
Yeah.
Other than from the customer.
Yeah. Other than from the
customer. Great job. Yeah. All right. Our last presentation, but certainly not the least, is our post 2028 EPA power contract status update. And Marie Morrison.
Morning, Marie.
Oh, it's going to be Garrison.
So sorry, not Marie. Garrison Morris, Senior Manager of Power Supply, gonna lead off real quick. So just to say, this contract we're gonna talk about, it's a big deal, right? We spend about $250 million a year on BPA power. It's a 16-year contract. This is about a, at minimum, $4 billion contract. Part of the reason we're talking today is that we must request as the PUD contract and a product from BPA by the end of June. So a reasonable question would be, well, how do we feel about the contract and what's the basis of the decision for the product? This is the contract discussion. So Marie has been our leader in power supply, our person in the room in Portland at representing the PUD at these BPA convenings. He's done a terrific, terrific job leading our internal team and our engagement. And for me, the headline is, we feel really good about this contract, but I wanna make sure that this commission knows that we feel really good about this contract in large part because of Marie's leadership. So I'm gonna hand it off to Marie to walk us through why that is, but I wanted this commission to hear that.
Thank you. Good morning, commissioners. I'm Marie Morrison, utility analyst for in the power supply department. As you heard from John, today is my presentation on the BPA power contract status update. We have been with the commission before. This is our fourth time to present on the post-2028 update. So today is only an informational briefing to the commission. No decisions are needed from the commission today, but I did have a secret objective, and that is to not get in between you and lunch, but I think we're pretty efficient today. So I think I will achieve that objective. So I'll just jump right in. There's a lot of words here, but this is all very important. So to get us grounded, let me talk a little bit about BPA. BPA is a federal power marketing agency that markets the power generated by the 31 federal hydroelectric dams managed and operated by the Bureau of Reclamation and the Army Corps of Engineers. BPA is self-funded, and so it covers its costs by selling its products and services. And BPA's obligation in the Pacific Northwest is grounded on statutes. They are obligated to offer power contracts to serve the needs of power public power utilities. And the PUD and BPA have an existing power contract that expires on September 30, 2028. And BPA also has contracts with other utilities that expire at the same time. So in order to prepare for that, there are several work streams that BPA started since
2022. So it's been 3 years now. And those are the contract terms and conditions, which is called the provider of choice, and the rate design that accompanies that contract, which is called the public rate design methodology. And I think an important bullet here is a fun fact that historically the PUD has been BPA's largest power customer. So where does BPA sit in our portfolio? In the power supply portfolio, BPA is the largest resource that we have, and it will continue. Starting October, it will be larger than what we currently have. You heard from Garrison that every year we spend approximately $250 million on BPA power costs. And so the outcomes of these post-2028 processes, the provider of choice, and the public rate design methodology will impact how we shape our future BPA costs. It will have wide-ranging effects. It's also important to note that an increase in BPA power costs translate directly to the cost that our customers pay. So very important. And also, we're also changing our BPA power product from what we currently have, block slice product, to the load falling product, because we're thinking of minimizing our costs and be resource adequate into the future. There's a lot to learn about this product. It will be a learning process, but we do want to understand how this product works and how it will fit into the provider of choice. So,
block size slice definition for our new commissioner. You don't need it if we do need it.
Thank you.
All right.
So we,
yes, please.
So the four C's. So we have, like I said, we've been to the commission before, but as a refresher.
Are you asking for the explanation?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh,
can you explain?
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Product. Thank you.
Yeah. So in terms of product, we currently have the block slice product. So that is a product where the block part is we get a certain portion of BPA power from BPA. And then there's an accompanying slice product. And with that slice product, we have we can market that product. So if we're surplus, we can sell that slice product to the market. And if we're deficit, we go to the market to supplement our load with it, because that's the current product that we have. But with the load following, we'll be able to follow our load. So if we need more power from BPA, BPA is obligated to serve that load. So that's the difference.
Thank you.
So the four C's, going into provider of choice, we told the commission we already have priorities going into the process. And these priorities are what you call the four C's. So first priority is contract high watermark, or really contract allocation. And it sets the access to low cost BPA power. Our goal here is to seek the largest principal allocation, because we're not the only one asking for that allocation. That is the goal there. The next C is carbon. We know we have our regulatory compliance requirements. So we seek the 100% clean BPA power product. Capacity. So when we think of capacity, we think of the ability to provide power hour by hour when we need it. We need it now. So BPA, give us that power now. So the goal here is to seek sufficient clean capacity so that we meet our load service needs. And then last C is cost. And we will look at the cost aspect looking at the public rate design methodology, which I said will accompany the provider of choice contract. And the desire here is to have a contract that is durable and is low cost for our customers. So let's dig into each of the four C's. The first C is contract allocation. Like I said, contract high water mark is access to low cost EPA power. So if you take a look at the chart on the left, you'll see how much we can access that low cost EPA power. Today, we sit at 811 average megawatts, and through engagement and work with BPA since 2022, that initial concept that really started below 700 average megawatts for us is now at a potential approximately 790 average megawatts. Why is this important? Because we know that our loads continue to grow. And with that potential, which is a substantial increase from the initial concept, we really feel good about it. And we did a back of the envelope calculation of how much that increase is for us, from less than 700 to approximately 790. And we calculated that the estimated grid savings for us is about $348 million over the life of the contract. So we feel really good about it. We know that we could not get to the 811 that we have today, but we feel that this is the largest principal allocation that we can get from BBA, because as we grow, other utilities also grow. And with a fixed system size, it's a challenge for BBA to accommodate that load growth.
Just a real basic question, I think. Today, is that all tier one power?
Yes, it is all tier one.
So then in terms of the difference between the, whatever the eight is, then does that automatically serve by tier two power?
Or
is
over and beyond 811 will be served by tier two power, which is not the low cost BBA power.
But that's the choice we have to take tier two, right?
Tier one and tier two for commissioner. Tier one is less expensive.
We will talk about tier one and tier two in a future slide, but anything above tier one, we have the option. We can serve it with non-federal resources, or we can serve it with BPA, but it would be the more expensive tier two resource. So tier one costs about $40 a megawatt today. Tier two costs about $62 a megawatt hour today. So we want as big of a tier one allocation as possible, because we're trying to avoid as much exposure to tier two as possible.
I've got a question about why is the high watermark going down from its current? Is it because the bottom bill is selling more power to more customers, or is it because they're expecting the system to produce less in the future?
So the system size in provider of choice will be fixed at 7,250 average megawatts, but in the initial concept, we were low because at that point, the adjustments were not detailed yet. Like, there is the conservation adjustment, economic adjustment. So the initial concept it's like putting everything in a basket, but BBA hasn't yet figured out how to allocation for each utility.
So. New contract, new allocation.
Right. So next, let's step on carbon. So it's important to us, it's a priority, because like I said, we know that we have to meet state compliance requirements. You heard from Jeff earlier today about Jeff Feinberg. There were two Jeffs today. Jeff Feinberg, the Energy Independence Act. So under the Energy Independence Act, we are required to show that 15%, to demonstrate that 15% of our of the load of our power delivered to our customers comes from renewable resources. So that is the compliance requirement for us. Now, how does the state measure if the utilities meet this requirement? Utilities, the state measures how utilities meet this requirement by using the renewable energy credits. And these are tradable certificates of proof that 1 megawatt hour of renewable energy is delivered to the customer. So we have to make sure that we show the state that we are in compliance with the Energy Independence, the renewables portion of that. So what are we seeing in provider of choice? The new REC allocation policy, which is policy tied directly to the megawatt hour purchased from EBA, is a good outcome for us. Today, that REC allocation policy is rounded on forecast. And if it's rounded in forecast, there's the uncertainty aspect. But going forward in provider of choice, tying that REC allocation policy to the megawatt hour purchased from EBA is a better outcome, because it takes the uncertainty aspect away from the equation. And another policy that is important in provider of choice is EBA is providing more options for cleaner power if a utility is above and beyond that low-cost EBA power. So as I mentioned earlier, that is tier two. We forecast that on the first day of the provider of choice contracts, we will step into that tier two category. So we have to think into the future how to still meet the Energy Independence Act renewables compliance requirement when we get into that category. And EBA is giving us options to do that by offering these options. We can purchase short-term, long-term, or resource-specific tier two options. So under the circumstances, that is a good outcome for us. Questions?
So I have a question regarding the tier one and tier two. So this is going to be in the hands of our customers, and the customer is going to decide.
Oh, as, yeah, okay, we will decide what option we're going to. Thank you. Thank you.
No, I'm
going to
hold my water.
I'll just say this underscores the benefit of efficiency.
It does, yeah.
Postpone tier two as long as possible.
But it doesn't represent our average system load.
The new tier one, does it represent our average?
Okay,
thank you. We're moving right along. Next C is capacity. Again, the goal is to seek sufficient clean capacity so that we meet our load service needs. Capacity is always a difficult concept to understand, so hopefully that bullet there, understanding capacity, is helpful. So again, capacity is the ability to provide power hour by hour when during the, I always think of this as an example, during the hottest day of summer and the coldest night of the winter, capacity is the ability of our resources to run up and down to align with load. Why is this a priority? Because we have experienced capacity shortfalls in recent years. And you will remember most recent major capacity shortfall we experienced was MLK week last year, and paid for that dearly. So capacity is important. Going forward with our change in the load following product, we are assured that BPA will provide that sufficient capacity that we need during those hours. And in my mind, BPA doesn't have a choice because they are obligated to provide that capacity to load following customers. There's also other products that BPA will offer, but those products have limited capacity attributes. So for us, those are less attractive. And then the last C is cost. Always important to us, we want to provide the lowest cost of power for our customers. So the desire is to get a contract that is durable and assures us that going forward, we will continue to keep that objective. I mentioned earlier that the way we look at cost is through the lens of the public rate design methodology, which is the new rate design that governs how costs are allocated between BPA's preference customers. And you also heard from me that when BPA costs increase, that translates directly to our customers. And so in the same vein, if BPA has low stable prices, that also translates to this to rate stability for our customers. With a new rate design methodology, what we're seeing is that because of the rate impact credit embedded in the construct of the rate design methodology, we see rate savings for us and our customers throughout the life of the contract. You see that in the chart here, approximately 3% every rate period. And we looked at the model, the PRDM model, and we saw that we are one of a handful of utilities with positive outcomes for provider of choice in PRDM. So, really happy.
These decreases for the customer are the power purchase side of the house. In other words, buying the bulk power from Bonneville. And there's another component to the customer rate structure, which is the cost of running the utility. And we're looking for different costs, different percentages.
Well, there's transmission costs for Bonneville.
Oh, yeah, right. You're right. Thank you. Thank you.
They're going up.
Oh.
So wrapping this up, these are the next steps for provider of choice and PRDM. Last week, BPA released the last iteration of the provider of choice contract template. And Power Supply and Legal are reviewing that template, and we will submit comments to BPA. The comment period ends April 9th. So we have engaged with BPA on this. There were several iterations of the contract template that BPA released, and we have commented on these, on those iterations. We'll continue to do that. You heard from Garrison that this is a precursor, a kickoff to the product request that we need to submit to BPA at the end of June this year. So this presentation is intended to provide context around that. We will go back to the commission for that piece of provider of choice process.
Is that process then negotiations further in terms of Sahamish's financial arrangement or the contract with Sahamish? Or is it all under one big contract? Is this another level where you actually go into further negotiation?
In a sense, we're getting really close to the end. It's almost a symbolic thing that we have to do next, which is we have to say, Bonneville, we want your provider of choice contract. 94% of our power portfolio. So we should, it's a pretty big hole if we didn't want the BPA, you know, contract, right? So we definitely want it. The product choice, though, that's a real one, right? There's multiple options. We'll talk through that in an upcoming commission presentation. And we've also recently looked at analysis, so a lot of that's really fresh for us. There will be a contract high watermark process, which finalizes our allocation. And there is a last leg of negotiation on the final contract template. And then there'll be individual contracts for each of the 100 plus BPA utility customers. All of those are continued engagement with Bonneville. We have a really great team, including Marie, Ava, our new attorney for power supply back there, all working on those things. So we expect to sign by the end of the year, but this part comes first, this formal request.
Thank you. So that's for the provider of choice. You know, like Garrison said, we're coming back for that product request. The BBA, just ceremonial, he said, so watch out for that one. As we speak, BBA is finalizing the contract high watermark policy implementation. We just heard from our rates department that the total retail load forecast that BBA is asking us to review is consistent with our load forecast. So, that number will be an input to the contract high watermark calculation. And then finally, the public rate design adoption concludes with a final record of decision in the PRDM proceeding. And the schedule for that is in May. So there's a lot here, but like I told the commission last year, we got this. So.
So,
good stuff.
Questions, Commissioner?
I have none.
Thank you for all your hard work on this, you and everybody. So I know this is a huge lift for us, and this is a 20-year contract, so big implications.
Thank you. Great job, Marie. Thank you. That is it for presentations. We had a few minutes. Happy to go into the GM report.
Yeah.
Just a few things to highlight for the commission. First off, the Team PUD Wellness Camp Challenge for March is a nutrition challenge. From March 5th to the 26th, employees are asked to swap a processed food snack for a whole food snack. Sounds easy, but it's not.
So you have to do that. Does it work? That's what.
Well, they say it works. I'm just
no, it works.
Say it works.
But it's
all the
time. Any time.
I want you to be healthy all the time.
You're just burned.
I am right.
So,
the
so calendar doesn't. Well, I know. That's what I
love. It is a good challenge for all of us and the things that are going on. Out of our HR group and our new health and wellness program manager, Jenny is doing a fantastic job. From CorpCom, our We Women Empowered board hosted an amazing Women in Leadership panel last week with over 110 attendees in a hybrid setting. Panelists included Lena Whitler, the CEO and General Manager for Clark Public Utilities, Snohomish County Sheriff Suzanne Johnson, and our very own Amy Carsons. After the panel, the event continued with networking lunches at four local restaurants. And I actually joined the panel a little bit late, but the feedback was just fantastic for all of the participants, and it was a great way for folks to get to know Amy as well. On March 13th, Gregor Weed, our line construction general foreman for Everett Line, and Kelly Stickney presented to the Kiwanis in Snohomish. Kelly provided a general update on the PUD, and Greg shared his experience working the mutual aid that we had provided Guam a couple of years ago. Today, our chief customer officer, John Hoffman, will be presenting at the Economic Alliance Coffee Chat on the green economy. I think you already did that. Is that right? Mm-hmm. I heard it was excellent. You'll be discussing the programs, or did discuss the programs for residential and commercial customers, as well as our investments in innovative technology. And as you all know, this Saturday is our North County office grand opening. A couple other things, customer and energy services, the My Snowpud Auto Pay balance check launched on March 7th, a highly anticipated improvement. We now perform a balance check scheduled auto pay payments. If the balance is over or lower or paid off, the auto pay payment amount is adjusted to match the current balance. This change prevents customers from overpaying if they have made payments, received pledges, or had credit supplied after the bill was issued. With CorpCom and Customer Energy Services partnering together on the Grow Paperless campaign, we've had 4,602 additional accounts that have been successfully transitioned from paper to paperless so far in 2025. And we'll continue this paperless campaign through the end of the year. Also, as February is historically a tough month for meter reading with snow and limited daylight, I'd like to brag on our meter reading group. They highlighted that in February, every meter reading route was completed on time with an impressive 99.89% accuracy. That is truly phenomenal, and a huge kudos to Wendy Vlahovich and the entire meter reading group. And that is it. Happy to answer any questions.
Switch out news report.
Thank you. Bet.
Next, we have item 5, public hearing in action. 5A, disposal of surplus property for the second quarter of 2025. I'll call for a motion.
That's a proposed motion. So I have to read the motion.
Yes.
I'm so sorry.
Yes, please.
Based on staff recommendation that the items are no longer necessary or useful to the district, I move that those items listed on Exhibit A and B of the surplus property recommendation report be declared surplus and be sold for high bid or disposed of according to policy in the second quarter of 2025.
Thank you. I'll now convene a public hearing. Claudia Lazar, and I will answer any questions. I'll first ask any comments from the public regarding the surplus property. Please raise your hand. No hands up online or in the room. Commissioners, do you have any questions about the surplus?
I have none.
Close public hearing. And I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Motion carried unanimously. Next, item 6, commission business. 6A, commission reports. Are there any reports, commissioner?
Last Thursday, we attended our retreat. That's the first retreat for me as the commissioner. So that was very nice to know more about, at least speaking for my opinion, it was very nice to hang out, for a few hours and learn more about the beauty and also know more about my colleagues. So I really want to say thank you. I appreciate that. So.
I really don't know. Yeah, I'll thank both of you for coming prepared. And we had great discussions about our policies and some things we want to look at in our meeting. And thank you very much to Colin for bringing together all the packets and for Allison for bringing it all together.
In a follow-up to that, given I've been through a lot of these over the years, I found it to be one of the most productive. Clear.
Yes.
I believe the board was very clear on changes that
made or that we, based upon some additional research, we may make.
Yes.
But I felt it was the most productive.
Yeah, and it was good to get to know our new commissioner. So, okay. Next is item 6B, our commission event calendar, which is page 130 of our packet. Are there any changes to be made to the commission events calendar?
Special meeting, but it's going to be noticed as a special meeting. But this Saturday, we're doing the North County office.
Yes. Yeah, the only change I have is yesterday I met with Energy Northwest General Counsel to discuss this. Just new for you, board. That's just a small change.
Oh.
Okay. Yeah, next is 6C. Oh, yeah. Consideration of resolution recognizing the dedicated service of Senior Counsel Sean J. Aronow. I'll call for a motion. Okay. So I am going to read the resolution out loud. So, Sean, I apologize for you having to sit through an entire meeting so we can appreciate you.
Are you ready to come
up
calling resolution for
surplusing
property?
Yeah, we're hoping to treat our retired employees better. So I'm going to read the resolution, we're going to vote on it, and then we've got a presentation for you. A resolution recognizing the dedicated service of Senior Counsel Sean J. Aronow. Ms. Aronow has served as Assistant General Counsel, now Senior Counsel, Republic Utility District Number 1 of Snohomish County, the district, since July 9, 2012, and has also served as interim general counsel. And whereas Ms. Aronow has dedicated her career to the practice of law, demonstrating an unwavering commitment to justice, integrity, and service to the community. And whereas through the past 12 years with the district, Ms. Aronow has provided exemplary legal counsel advocating for the district, the commission, and the employees with the utmost professionalism, expertise, and compassion. And whereas Ms. Aronow has significantly contributed to the success of the district through her leadership and guidance to the generation and water utility teams. And whereas Ms. Aronow has been a critical partner on numerous construction, maintenance, and relicensing projects associated with the Woods Creek Hydroelectric Project, Hancock Creek Hydroelectric Project, Callaghan Creek Hydroelectric Project, and Jackson Hydroelectric Project, all of which improve the reliability and longevity of the district's clean, renewable generating fleet. And whereas Ms. Aronow was an instrumental leader in the district's tidal energy project, the first deep water tidal energy array licensed by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, after a 7-year licensing process that engaged local, state, and federal regulatory agency, environmental groups, the marine industry, and others. And whereas Ms. Aronow has helped the water utility and its 9 separate community water systems navigate complex system expansions, construction and maintenance projects, easement and land use issues, permitting negotiations, and long-term financing. And whereas Ms. Aronow has demonstrated a long commitment to supporting others and the principles of fairness and equity through her volunteerism on the district's inclusion committee, safety committee, benefits advisory committee, and environmental stewardship committee, formerly the environmental advisory team. And whereas Ms. Aronow has consistently upheld the highest ethical standards in everything that she does and has made significant contributions to the district and the communities it serves. Now, therefore, be it resolved on behalf of the district and its customers, the Board of Commissioners of Public Utility District Number 1 of Snohomish County, Washington, extends its heartfelt thanks to Sean J. Aronow for her distinguished career and tireless efforts on behalf of the district, and extends its best wishes to Ms. Aronow in her retirement. Passed and approved this 18th day of March, 2025.
Come on down here.
take the vote first. If you don't vote yes, it's going to be awful awkward. Okay. I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion carried. All right. Don, how many times did I butcher your last name? Every time?
It's okay to... resolution this morning, and I said, there's no way in hell I can do that. I've never been able to pronounce it
in the middle.
Well, I did. My church.
It's real.
Thank you for everything. Okay.
Here it is. Oh, it's special.
It's really big.
Yeah. It felt like those little glass trophies, didn't it? Oh. You got to have wall space.
Can I hold it?
Oh, let's get a picture.
Okay.
Crazy. Well, thank you all for all you've done for our customers and for us. You've filled in several times, and I've always, your advice has always been helpful and positive and very useful and well thought out. So
I'm always happy that you take it.
Thank you.
It's not wasted.
And you're not being surplus.
No. It makes me feel really good. Thank you. Thank you.
Personal note. You would sometimes be in the audience, sometimes be listening through the internal communication system. And I'd be having a hissy fit. And few people can calm me down. And I'd go upstairs. She'd come out of her office. She'd say, Tony, calm down. It's going to work. And you're one of the few. And I thought, okay, she says it's going to be fixed or it's going to work. So I'm happy. Anyway, it was, and you did that a lot with me. And I thank you.
Well, you always showed your dedication to the PUD. And
wasn't that nice of her to say?
I've always appreciated that. So thank you. Certainly, you know, working with you.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I haven't had the opportunity to work with you, but I'm listening.
Okay.
Don't you worry.
How am I going to be worried about it? No, but thank you for your legacy.
It's been an incredible career here in time, and I have to say that I'm so proud to work with everyone at the PUD, all of you in this room. And it is one of the best jobs I think an attorney could ever have. And this team, this organization, every day shows up, and that is just incredible, and it makes me want to show up. And you all do such important jobs, and I feel like the only thing that I could ever do was to just make it easier, just try and fix it or make it work or find another way forward for us all. So thank you for that.
Thank you very much.
Great. Awesome. All right. Great. This is just the beginning of the farewell tour. Like every big rock star, we'll have a team lunch on Thursday, but then next Thursday will be kind of the internal retirement celebration for all staff to kind of recognize Sean as well. So look forward to seeing you all there.
Next is item 7, governance planning. Our governance planning calendar, item 7A, which is page 143 of our packet. Are there any changes to be made to the governance planning? Or John? Or Allison?
I got nothing added to the
state. We have our North County ribbon cutting. Can we put in the word to have good weather?
Please.
Is there any further business to come before the board? Okay. It is now 11:48. And the board will recess into executive session to review negotiations on the performance of a public bid contract. It is anticipated the executive session will last for approximately 30 minutes and conclude at 12:18. The board will then hold a second executive session to discuss current or potential litigation. It is anticipated the executive session will last approximately 30 minutes and conclude at 12:48. The commission is not expected to take any further action following either executive session and will adjourn the regular meeting upon us. 12:43 and our second executive session and our first executive session have concluded.